One thing missed during commercial property due diligence can cause you a lot of financial heartache. Hi, I'm Joe Krause. I'm the co-host of the Property Powers Australia podcast with Sam Powell. And in this episode, we chat to Steve Polizzi, who's the founder of the buyer's agency firm Polizzi Property, where they've bought over 1,000 properties for clients. And he's also the author of the book Commercial Property Explained Simply. Now, we're doing a series here on commercial property. This is episode number 51. There's four more prior to this that are super valuable. Make sure you go away and check those out. But in this podcast, Steve, Sam and I listed out, well, Steve actually listed out his 100-point due diligence checklist items. We didn't get through absolutely every one of them because there's so many to check when doing DD on commercial property, but some of the main key ones. We also discussed mezzanine risks in properties, lease agreement risks, tenant risks, and so much more in terms of risks and understanding due diligence. We do cover what type of documents you also need from all the different parties working on selling the commercial property that you're looking at buying. From people like the vendor, the tenant, future tenant, accountants, all these sorts, so many people involved in the deal. And there's so many documents you need, like so many. And you need to be able to get them, understand them, or look at them, interpret them, and understand them. So make sure you go through those very, very, very thoroughly if you're buying this on yourself or by yourself. Steve also explains what type of commercial properties typically take more work during due diligence and why those types of properties take more work. And lastly, we discuss the difference between buying something cheap and something at a fair market value or slightly higher. And we also discuss where you can play in between with different nuances at times. Now, there's so much value in this podcast episode. There's also going to be links in the show notes to get Steve's book with our Property Powers code. Make sure you check out the four episodes prior to this, as this is going in linear fashion if you haven't yet listened to those. But for now, let's dive in. Welcome to Property Pals, the podcast where we share everything around how to build a property portfolio, from researching areas, financing, structuring, buying, selling, and reinvesting to live a life of financial independence. As a disclaimer, any information shared by myself, Jared, Sam, and the Property Pals team is strictly general and should not be taken as constituting professional advice. You should consider seeking independent legal, financial, and taxation advice from a qualified professional.
Rightio, we're back into Property Pals Australia with Steve Polizzi, Property, all the P's. we're in a commercial property deep dive, and we're going to jump into due diligence checks because this is a massive area of, I guess, people not doing enough. And Steve's got a 100-point checklist that you go through?
Yeah, I think it's about 120, but 100-point sounded nicer on social media.
All about those figures. Yeah. Well, I guess the biggest... the benefit of using someone like yourself, obviously, buyer's agent, is that you do it all for you, and it's a very long process. What'd you say? It was like 40 hours or something like that?
Yeah, on average, our DD report takes about 20 to 40 hours collectively. So, like, we've got an in-house valuer that does their part, and then we've got someone else who does, like, all the other checks, and then there's a checker for that as well. So there's kind of 20 to 40 hours on average. And I'm not saying you don't have to use a buyer's agent. Obviously, I encourage it because I'm a buyer's agent, but... Well, I've given out all the information, like on these podcasts, the due diligence checklist, you can get it on my website, you got the books and stuff, you can do it, but it's not an armchair investing task. Like people think with residential, like, oh, I go on realestate.com and I'll throw a few offers by email and call a couple agents. And if they accept the offer, cool, I've done a good job. I'll do a couple little checks and I'm all right. Before you even make an offer, you've probably got around 2 to 4 hours work. Then once you've got the offer accepted, then the real work starts under the due diligence. So I'll probably start off by saying that the main difference with commercial is most of the contracts are subject to due diligence. So unless you go to auction or something like that, we have to do it beforehand, but you'll generally get 14 to 35 days due diligence based on the size of the deal. And then that's when the real work starts. That's where you have to do everything, even just collecting documents. Like you should be asking for about 20, 30 documents from the agent. Then it's cross-checking all those and doing all the stuff we're going to go over on this podcast.
Yeah, so what I mean, from top down, like, is there sort of a structure that you go, like, this is the first, second, third, or is it just, look, you just got to go and collate, get all of it, and then sift through it?
What we actually find is we kind of do it in stages. So when we first go under subject to due diligence, we'll ask for the criticals. So, like, things like the leases, the approvals, any key documents like insurances and things like that, just because so we can actually start the process. Because there's so many documents, we actually found, and when I was a one-man band, I'd send the list of like 20 documents, and I found the agents just wouldn't do it because it's kind of too much. They're just kind of like, this is way too hard. Yeah. But if you simplify it for them, like, oh, can I have this, this, and this, and this, and then like a few days later, oh, I've just noticed we need this and we need this. Like, oh, do you have the maintenance schedule for the air conditioning? Like, you could kind of drip feed it from, which is annoying because it'd be nice just to be like, here's my list. Please give it to all of me. But agents, without bad-mouthing them, they're notoriously lazy and they want the deal done with as least effort as possible. So, we kind of do it in stages, like just critical to non-critical to then what else you can get.
It's kind of like the difference between like having a child and just saying, here's a bowl of food, have it all at once.
Yeah.
I was at Sam's place, he's feeding his son. It was like cracking it. It was hilarious. Got a good photo. I should put it here on the pod. But making consumable is so important. Like, I've got a due diligence checklist in one of my other businesses, and I've had people say they send the whole thing to the seller of the business, and they're just like, I'm doing all the work for you, like, and then it's just too much for them. You got to deliver it to them in a consumable rate. Mm-hmm. So in that consumable rate, you've got the tenant, those important things first, and then what do? Do you just punch through all the other things on the checklist? And if so, what are those?
Yeah, so this is a hard thing as well. So you got to remember, the selling agent isn't the property manager. Sometimes the selling agent, and that's how they've got the sale, is the same company, but it's a different division. But a lot of times the property manager is different. Sometimes it's self-managed as well. So the actual owner, so the agent is actually the conduit. Like, they're the ones that they don't really care. They just want you to say yes to the deal, but they've kind of got to feed off other people. And that's why they actually have the documents. And most of our extensions are actually based on not getting information, where I can't wholeheartedly say to the client, go under contract, no conditions anymore when we don't have this information. But there's different methods you can get it from. Like, you might actually contact the property manager or the owner directly. Agents don't generally like that, but you can do it. And then weirdly, the tenant obviously has a lot as well, like checking their public indemnity and they're checking the leases registered and things like that. The tenant can send you that, but be wary of that. Don't just call up the tenant and be like, send me all these documents, because they're kind of going to be like, well, who the bloody hell are you? Like, so you kind of ease into it. But yeah, basically once we've got the crutch, then we just go through all the stuff, and I'll quickly ramble. Like, big ones are like lease review, contract review, tenant interviews. If it's retail, road and traffic analysis, like foot and road traffic analysis. The big one we mentioned on the last podcast, vacancy study and occupancy study, how long they stay there for. Business competition analysis. So that's quite important for retail, for instance. Like, if you're buying a medical center, where are the other medical centers? Are there new ones potentially going to open up? Vacancy study, occupancy study, medical, comparable sales, obviously, to check the square meter rate. Because when I mentioned before about doing like 2 to 4 hours at the start, you're only really going to be able to have the time to check 2 to 4, maybe 5 deals. And that's probably, I probably should have mentioned the last podcast, one of the risks and the hard parts with due diligence is lack of information. Like, you don't just look online and be like, oh, here's all sales. Yes, you go on CoreLogic and 90% of the time the price is right. But then sometimes, like, a lot of the times for us, we buy a property and we actually get a 100, 200 grand price reduction because we found something wrong with it. So getting confidence in those numbers. The other hard one is actually looking at like comparable rentals. So you can have a look on CoreLogic and look at like a sales campaign. They might say, oh, we advertised this for lease for 50 grand a year and it was on there for 2 weeks. Does that mean they had a 2-week vacancy, or did they take a month to advertise it? Did they just get someone to say yes to the property and then it was another 2 months? And what were the incentives? So there's all of a sudden this grunt work you start doing of calling property managers being like, what do you got on the books at the moment? How long was it tenanted for? What was the square meter rate? What were the incentives? So this is the thing. It's probably lack of information when doing due diligence, and knowing how to get the information is probably the hardest part.
Coming back a step, maybe, when you find, like, you say you found a property And then do you go under letter of intent and then due diligence and then contract, or is it a different way? Because I thought it was like sign a contract, but it's not the end figure or deal. And then how does it work?
It's case by case. Like it depends. Like so, yeah. Most of the time, I'm going to make up a number here. About 80% of the time, we just go under contract, subject to due diligence. Okay. Normally, if there's something holding it up, like a lease, say the purchase is based on getting a lease signed, you might sign a heads of agreement or something like that, which is kind of like it's almost like an option where you're signing, you're kind of there. But normally, you're just signing the contract, subject to due diligence, subject to finance. If it's a complicated deal, you might have special conditions that base it, but most of the time, my job is to get it. If I think it's a good deal, get it locked in under contract as quick as I can, because I'm not risking anything. I can get my deposit back if we pull out, and then start the negotiations there. You find the seller and the agent are more susceptible to changes if they think it's going to go through. So like if we do all that due diligence and we just find like, oh, the mezzanine's not approved, we can kind of approve due diligence based on that. So we say, hey, look, we either want money off the price. So like I'm a structural engineer by trade, so I can actually look at stuff and go, oh, look, it looks like it's to code. Let's get 15, 20, 30 grand off the price, knowing it costs about 10 grand to get it approved. Or we can extend settlement and get them to approve it and remove the risk completely. Or we can crash the deal. And the seller's more likely to say yes to something like that, where you're like, hey, everything's great with the property. We're happy with it. We will proceed if you do this, rather than kind of like, oh, can we have a 3-month extension while we work this out? So yeah, you generally just like work through the criticals, and then some things you let go. Like we've bought properties that don't have mezzanines approved, for instance, and we go into that knowing full well that there's a risk. One of the key risks while we're talking due diligence is it actually doesn't get approved. Most of the time it doesn't get approved is because of car spots, surprisingly. So it's not the actual structural build of it, because mezzanines aren't that hard to build. Like there are a couple like UB beams and some columns and stuff like that. You can always replace a beam and kind of make it work. But what happens from the extra floor space, most of the councils and zoning, you need a certain amount of car spots per floor space. But in a body corporate complex, you can't just build more car spots. So it gets rejected on that. Then there's obviously issues with finance, because they're not taking into account unapproved mezzanine area as part of the square meter rent. So even though you're getting rent for it, they're not taking it into account. So they actually shade the rent. So that might actually, the valuation might come in 20% short. So this is what we're talking about. There's all these layers of complexity where you can do it yourself, but unless you know how to fix a problem when you find it, it becomes very kind of complicated.
I got a question around those mezzanines. Like if they are unapproved, if it's an unapproved structure and something happens, like on the tenant, like where does the insurance sit on that? Like are you as the owner liable if, say, someone broke their leg in an unapproved mezzanine region?
Generally not, because the tenant's got public indemnity and you'll get some form of protection as well. Normally what we do, and sometimes we actually need this for finance, so while it's unapproved, we can actually just send a structural engineer to certify it to say it's to code. Then that way you're covered, because you've got basically a certificate saying, look, this is built to code, it's not going to collapse. But that's been my fear in the past as well. We had one recently. I was quite like, we found the property. This bit of an interesting story, actually. Like it's a warehouse, but it's a swingers club. So they go there at nighttime and do their fun stuff.
How'd you come across this one,
man? Yeah. And then when we bought it, I said to the client straight away, I said, look, banks don't like this, because they're going to put it in the same category as a brothel, and they don't like brothels. Like they rate it a higher risk. That was my risk. And then that sort of did happen. They did that anyway. And then I called an insurance broker being like, the lease wasn't actually registered with the council, so they didn't actually have approval of being there. And I said that, I said, what happens if someone like, I don't know, is smoking and it burns the place down and we covered? And they're like, no, you actually are covered, because it's effectively just a club. Like just because it's a swingers club, that is no different to like a poker club. For instance, like it's all consensual. It's not actually a brothel. So we actually made sure we had insurance for that case, and we're still buying the property, but the issue is the finance with that one, because the banks don't like it.
Interesting. There's, there was one thing that I was going to yell out earlier, and it sounds like with the due diligence checks, going back to that, is that you're getting the seller and the agent like more invested in the process by doing those incremental steps. Is that sort of like what you're sort of finding as well?
As much as you can. The biggest and hardest thing probably for me is you don't actually get all the documents a lot of the times. Like I've asked for ones where you say, oh, can we have rental statements to show the tenant's always paid on time? And if it's the owner manager themselves, sometimes they say no because they're some old school bloke that doesn't realize like you can go on internet banking and filter per that transaction to show it. So they just kind of get there, they cross their arms like, no, I'm not giving you my bank statements. And you're just like, can you like give us some form? And so that would be a gut call where you're like, okay, we're going to talk to the tenant and ask them if they paid on time. And there is a risk with that. Like they might be lying to you. They might be best friends with the owner or something like that, or they're planning to leave and they're lying and things like that. So this is what I mentioned before about like the analysis paralysis can get involved in well, but that's why I always focus on quality. Like if you buy something that's really in demand, absolute worst case is you lose your tenant and you get someone in quickly. One of the benefits with commercial, and you can't do this residential, if they don't meet the terms of the lease, you can literally go change the locks, kick them out of the business. It's not a personal thing. It's a contract and you move on, you put the next tenant in.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. So let's what's the next phase of due diligence checks that you sort of, feed in a consumable way to the...
Yeah, so the big one is the comparable sales and comparable rentals. So like that's the one where firstly we want to make sure like for your property, Jared, that we're getting a good price. And by good price doesn't mean the cheapest price in the market. You're not going to buy the cheapest one. Are we buying at least a fair market price? If not, good. I always tell people, I'd rather buy a fair market price in a better market than a below market property in a soft market. Like,
really, you can listen to the Property Pals podcast, mate. Jared's
a really good quote from Warren Buffett. He says it's better to buy a good business at a fair price. And you say business is a property. So it's better to buy a good business at a fair price than a fair business at a good price.
Yeah. So. He must have got that from my podcast.
Yeah. So like obviously cheap is not like, the way I explain it is if you go to Bunnings Warehouse and there's two types of tape measures, one's $10 and one's $50, which one are you going to buy? I'm buying the $50 one because it's a better product and I'm going to have less troubles with it, less risk, it's less likely to break. So let's not buy cheap.
Yeah. However, if you're someone like me who's kind of can't do that stuff himself anyway, I'll buy the $10 one knowing that I'm only going to use it twice and then it's going to live in a drawer.
That's a good point.
So many case by cases here.
Case by case.
I'd sit there and go, because I know this is like in the buyer's agent realm, right? Like all my consumable brain goes down there is there's people that do charge larger fees because they've got really good marketing and therefore they've got that higher demand coming through and they try to reduce, I guess, the number of people they can work with by having that higher fee. So don't get caught up in just that from the buyer's agent realm. That's why you're listening to this is either you do it yourself or you go through a buyer's agent. But look at the runs on the board, look at, obviously the history and get to know the person, read their books, listen to their podcasts. That's something that I would say from it's probably more risk assessment on the buyer's agent side, which we might do a potty in the future on.
Yeah, and that's one of the ones where I find it baffling that people make the decision based on like $3,000 or $5,000. Like you get some inquiries and like, well, this company's doing it for this price. And you're like, cool, go accept that price. Like I charge based on what I think I'm worth. And this is going to sound bad, but also the demand I have. Like my bottleneck is finding good quality properties. And I could be a buyer's agent that does 50 deals a month and they're mediocre deals. But because I want to keep quality high, I charge a bit more because I'm working with less clients and hopefully giving a better output. And this is the arrogant part. If at the moment, like I have more inquiries than I have properties. So it's not the client inquiries are the issue. So I'm generally just going to keep upping my fees. And like I said, I know it sounds arrogant to the listeners, but I'd rather, like I said, focus on the good quality and do less deals than just try to become a sausage factory, spitting out 50 deals a month.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So coming back to the next phase of DD, what have we got on that checklist of yours?
All right. So I'm going to pull the checklist up and I'm actually just going to ramble for a couple minutes of kind of giving you an idea of what type of documents you need. This is going to sound a bit overwhelming to people. So download the checklist. But like, for instance, for the site, you need site plan, floor plans, as-built drawings of the building, parking schedules, land tax assessment, inventory list, council documents, management agreements, certificate of currency, which is the building insurance, body corporate report, title reference and property title search, details of easements, restrictions, drainage and sewer diagrams, details of shared access or right-of-way arrangements. That's actually probably quite a good one as well. If you're buying retail, sometimes there's shared driveways and things like that you need to be mindful of. So that's just the documents for the site. Then you've got OH&S. So that's hazardous materials register and reports, details of hazardous materials stored on site, and any construction materials on this property as well. So you've got to get that as well. Then you've got service contracts. So based on what you're buying, if you're buying like multi-tenanted property or you're getting like a body corporate one, you want to look at roof maintenance, air conditioning maintenance, lift and escalator maintenance, interior plants maintenance, outdoor landscaping, cleaning maintenance, hazard waste removal, rubbish removal, parking contracts, property management contracts, security contracts, and utility contracts. So you've got that as well. Then in regards to like looking at, we mentioned before, you want comparable sales, comparable rentals, foot and road traffic analysis, historical occupancy study and vacancy periods. For council and town planning, you want to look at the development consents and conditions, construction certificates, occupation certificates, building certificates, fire safety certificates, heritage listed documents, and conservation documents. Then you've got zoning, type of zoning, future potential zoning, information from town planner. Then you need to assess value add opportunities if you're buying like a freestanding site or body corporate, like where you can do mezzanines and solar panels. So it's like changing the use, raising rents, improving the quality and image of the property, creating new sources of revenue, marketing the property, removing underperforming tenants, better property management and development potential as well. So like that's just me rambling some of the key ones. There's actually another 3 pages. So I won't go through all those. I realize how long it's actually going to take. You've got rental ledgers and documents, identity check of the business, proof of payments, evidence of assets, reference of the tenant's previous landlords. Then there's a whole business analysis. So that's where you kind of like ask the questions of like who the tenant is, how long they've been operating, do they have any other like locations? All those questions I mentioned before about finding out the negatives of the property. So there's about 20 questions there. Then you got lease review. So that you'll pay a solicitor. Then you'll also do your own lease review and you'll look at like, has there been any subleases, amendments, rental abatements, what licensing they have, what car parks, what guarantees, what evidence of payments, what fixtures and fittings they have, what depreciation schedules, lease details, rent review. Then there's security, check all the security. Then there's fit out and make good clauses. Then there's insurances. Then there's the outgoing check. Then there's the repairs and maintenance check, assignment and subleasing. Then there's tax and then there's special conditions. And then there's photos, videos, building pest inspections, and then we are done. Whew, that was a mouthful.
That was great, Steve. Thank you. So, guys,
I rambled. Get the spreadsheet. I left out about half of it, but I just so you didn't listen to me for 10 minutes rambling.
Yeah, we might get that due diligence checklist. It's on your website anyway, if they want to just go.
We're on the website. Chuck it on your website. Put it in the show notes. What do we need?
Like it's really, really, really key because this. Like you can see, there's so much there, and even one mistake on like something in this due diligence test can cost you like 20 grand, right? Like, and that's where it's like, well, you know your worth, as Steve said, like you know your worth, and that you're providing a lot more value than what the fees you're charging, and
You don't have to do it all. Like there's been plenty of investors that have done all right from not doing it as detailed as me. But for me, like if I'm spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, I'm going to do the extra 10, 20 hours work just to kind of cross-check. Mainly not so much. A lot of these ones, I actually don't get the documents or I actually find like there's a negative with it. But it's another negotiating tool. If I can get a client on my own property an extra 20, 30 grand off, like that's a year's worth of savings for some people. Like just because I've had like all these red flags. But as I mentioned at the start, focus on the fundamentals first, like where the property is, what the demand is, do the big stuff, like what's the condition of the building, check there's no special levies, get your building pest inspection, which I probably should have mentioned at the start. Building and pest inspection and body corporate review are obviously the big ones. And make sure holistically it's fine. If you find something like the tenant missed a payment or something like that, it's not ideal, but it's not going to bankrupt you. Like, so make sure the area and the asset type is the most important thing.
How far back do you go with tenant ledgers, like if you get access to that?
To 24 months normally, but minimum I generally ask for 12 months just to go as much as you can get. It's a case by case. If the tenant's been there for 10 years and you see from the last 6 months they've paid every time, I probably won't push for 12 months because I know I'm going to talk to them and if they're like, yeah, we're happy here, we're paying rent on time and we've got from the owner that they are paying rent on time, there's that. Where that actually became a real big issue was at the start of COVID, obviously. Like I had to see the rental ledgers to make a commitment because with commercial, the lease doesn't necessarily get updated. So there could have been, the owner could have been giving a rental concession of no rent or reduced rent, or a payback system or something like that. So there was much more critical then. But now that we're a little bit through that, it's generally the 6 to 12 months will give me some assurance.
What did it get? No, what COVID in my mind just brings it. If you could pay your rent through COVID, that's a really strong sign of a solid tenant. Is that sort of what you think?
Yeah, it is as well. But then I actually found a lot of the really strong tenants just use it as an excuse to actually to get a rental reduction. But it depends what you're buying. Like I personally have a cafe. So I actually gave him a rental concession during COVID, and I just did it simply. I actually got him to send me his financial statements based on like what went through the till effectively. And I gave him a percentage. So if his business dropped by 50%, I gave him 50% less rent. So that way he's kind of still surviving all right. Yes, what I'm sure and I'm positive he's probably done this is anything that came in cash into the till didn't go into the books. It went into his back pocket instead. But again, he liked me and stayed on because of that. And I actually got him to sign a longer lease because of it.
Did he paint that one?
Which would have increased the value of
the property. Actually, I mentioned that in a previous podcast. Yeah, that's the one he's painted as well. That was actually really just prior to COVID as well. So maybe that hurt his cash flow a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I guess good quality tenants is obviously key, right? Like you're investing for the income and the capital growth, but you need the income to service the loan. So that's probably a lot of those due diligence checks. Do they center around the tenant?
Yeah, there's actually weird as well. Like I actually found like we had some like some industrial warehouses that were say like CrossFit gyms and things like that. And some of them completely obviously shut down and stopped paying rent. Other ones, this rent just kept ticking over and you're just like, well, someone's got some cash that they're okay kind of going through. So like it's case by case, but COVID, certain businesses obviously took off. And I've got to stop saying case by case. I know that. But like the distribution businesses just flourished as well. Like they were going gangbusters.
Yeah.
Which properties are more heavy on due diligence? Like which ones take a little bit longer or a bit more like type of asset class, I should say.
Yeah.
It depends sort of scenario here, but in general terms.
Easy answer, retail. Retail, there are way more risks. Like industrial, you get like for like comparison. Like it is just concrete tilt-up panels, roller door. So you can actually find comparables. You can go, okay, look, there's five other warehouses in this complex that are comparable. What do they rent for per square meter? What do they sell for per square meter? If they went vacant, how long they were vacant for? Then you can go like 500 meters away to another industrial complex and still assess the numbers where an industrial tenant doesn't really care if you're in this complex or that complex. It's just the numbers. So you're making that one based on the numbers and less the tenant. Again, unless it's like a big blue chip tenant, unless you're buying a Bunnings or like a big freestanding warehouse where the tenant's really important. So the smaller ones that, but retail, it's almost like a bit of a black art. You have to analyze the business. So you have to like how susceptible they are to failing, what their risk profile is. Competition analysis, you actually have to assess the foot traffic in the area. It's going to sound a bit airing fairy, even the buzz of the area. Like, so we've inspected ones where they're all paying rent on time. That all looks really attractive. They're strong yields. But then you inspect the property and there's kind of no one there. Like they're all tenanted, but it's like a weird little ghost town kind of retail strip. And then other ones you go there and it's the same rent, but there's just hundreds of people walking around and you're like, okay, this is going to do really well long-term. But understanding the business is where most people fall over with retail. The trap people fall into is they think they understand it. So they go like, oh, this location's great. There's a hairdresser there. I'd love to go to that hairdressing location, which is good in theory, but you have no idea how profitable hairdressers are, for instance. Most of them actually fail, but they don't fail in regards to a closed shop. They normally get taken over by someone else. But one of the simple things, which is like, and it's in my book, assess who runs the business. If it's one owner and they've got three staff, you are underpinning that owner stays there and works hard, doesn't have life circumstances or falls pregnant or, I don't know, gets ill. Like that's really risky. So I like the businesses that generally have like 10 to 15 staff because they're kind of big enough that if someone steps away, it kind of keeps ticking over. So that one you kind of got to understand the business as well. And that's the hardest one. Because there actually is no right answer. It is impossible to say if a business, and you look at this personally, Jared, with your business as well, if they're going to be long-term sustainable. You can look at their profitability, but you've got to focus on the next 5-10 years as well. It's like a petrol station. Petrol stations yield really well right now. I can buy 7-9% ones. The unknown is how long is that petrol station going to be there with the kind of zero emissions coming? And then you've got the land contamination issue. So you actually have to do that. But again, as long as you know what you're doing, you can assess that risk. We actually bought one in Queensland recently, a petrol station that had a Woolworths and a BWS next to it. And we've actually treated the petrol station like it's not going to be there in 10 years. So we got a good yield and we're actually setting aside the land contamination, which is going to be probably 200, 300 grand, knowing that we at some point we're going to have to transform it. But the numbers made sense because of the Woolworths BWS and we're planning for that. So we're taking on the risk, got the extra yield, but planned for it.
I'm sure like a Woolworths with a BWS and a petrol station, it's like a one-stop shop for people to get everything. So I'm sure the yield is really good on that one initially in the short term. And then you've got your long-term plan in place as well, right?
Yeah. That's what I like this one as well, because it was on a roundabout on a major like intersection. So I'm like, okay, we can convert the petrol station into something like another supermarket, more car spots, a car dealership or whatever. It had some form of options. But again, it's still a hard unknown because you're like, what's this actually going to be? And I wouldn't probably recommend that for a first-time investor. Like this is a well-established investor that can take on the risk.
What's your rulings around the contamination? Like not your rulings, but is it you got to have the site vacant for a few years from memory, or am I like, what's the go there?
There's the even part of due diligence. When we actually buy it, we do a land contamination study. So you actually pay for the study to see if it's already contaminated. It's just testing. I actually personally have never actually been through the whole thing. I've only kind of heard stories of it. But I normally talk to people that have done it and find out the cost, because that's how I assess the cost. But I believe I've actually got a civil engineer in my team. And I think you're right. There's a 12 to 24 month testing once they've pulled it out. Sometimes they actually leave the tanks in there. So you'll actually leave the petrol tanks below and build on top. So I've actually bought previously a retail strip of shops that's sitting above an old petrol station when the tanks are still in there. And again, we took on the risk. And we assessed it and we said, oh, what happens if it starts leaking? We have to knock it down. And that was part of the analysis as well.
Damn. Love it. Yeah, the things you learn by doing it every day, hey?
Yeah.
What would be one thing, before we finish this episode up, what would be one thing, one piece of advice you'd give to people, Steve, around this due diligence checklist? And other than obviously getting it and going through it, but yeah, when somebody's doing DD, what's, you know, your major piece of advice you'd give them?
If you don't know something, ask someone. So there's people that like my business that will just do due diligence, but ignoring that, without trying to upsell, there's some really good conveyancers out there that have done thousands and thousands of commercial deals. Ask them, say, oh, look, I'm a bit worried about this. What do you recommend? And then they might recommend a solicitor to do a review or this, and even just give you feedback or just find someone who's actually done it before. But I'd say a piece of advice is if you don't know what you're doing, keep it simple at the start. I get so many clients that are like, Steve, I want below market value, under rented with value add for my first commercial. I'm like, that's a risk. And there's like, no, why is making money a risk? I'm like, people aren't idiots. They don't sell the property for much cheaper for fun. Like you're taking on some level of risk by getting this value.
My last question is just around the due diligence clause that you put in. Like, from a negotiation point of view, obviously, you want to try and make it as easy as possible for the seller to accept that offer. Is that sort of the same with commercial, or are they happy to do like a 30-day due diligence check? So would you use a 12-day due diligence to, you know, kind of sweeten that deal? What's the view?
Yep. So you're giving away all the secrets, Sam. Generally 14 to 21 days. Based on like the agents, but we'll normally go shorter because you're more like if say another offer comes up and they've got a 42-day due diligence clause and we've got the same price and we're 14 days, they're going to accept ours. Funnily enough, I know that it's very hard to get it done in 14 days. It actually normally takes 21 or 35 days, for instance. But as I mentioned before, if you say to them, we're satisfying due diligence except for these items and our acceptance is based on these, they're much more likely to accept because you've paid the deposit, you've paid a building and pest inspection, you've done a lease review, you've done your searches, everything's lined up. You've sent them finance approval, so that's good to go. It's a decision of yes, a couple of weeks to get the deal done versus no, we're not going to extend, we're crashing the deal, going to go to the other buyer with 30 days due diligence and go through the whole process again. So I always try to lock the deal in as much as I can. There is a risk, one in probably 20, and you get burnt, you say, can we have an extension? They say, no, we've got a cash offer now, see you later. That happens. And you're going to have lost 3 to 5 grand on searches and things like that. But yeah, you got to pay to play. Unfortunately, it's nothing's free.
So work like AquaSpeed with your, I guess, negotiations is big what we're all about. But by the sound of it, due diligence and knowing what you're doing is so important. So, yes, yeah, thanks for jumping on, Steve. We're obviously got a few more episodes to jump into in the future. But if you're just listening to this podcast, go back. We've done, I think, what's this, number 5 with Steve? Yeah. So there's some really good, yeah, I guess, foundational episodes that you're going to pick a lot up, and then jump into this due diligence checks. And once again, Steve's got an amazing book, both residential and commercial. But jump on his website. Jared says that it's free, but it's $40. But with Property Pals code, you'll get it for free. And at the very least, get educated. That's probably the biggest risks that we're picking up during this podcast episode. And yeah, Jared, you have anything else you want to jump in on?
Oh, Sam, you've taken me job. co-hosting thing. No, that's it. Thanks so much, Steve. Cheers.
Nah, awesome, guys. Thanks. Pleasure.